This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up in today's programme, we'll be bringing you the latest information available on what has been treated as a terrorist attack in Sweden, where at 2:53 p.m. local time, a truck drove into pedestrians in a busy central street in Stockholm. It's believed that at least three people have been killed. The Trump administration has made the unprecedented move of carrying out an attack against the Assad government in Syria. We'll be taking a look at the sudden shift in the administration's policy. We will also be looking closely at what the US attacks on Syria mean for the role of the United Nations and respect for international law in a move that appears to be a clear breach of international standards, with no mandate or consultation taking place in either the UN Security Council or with the US Congress. The decision by over 100,000 Muslim clerics to gather in protest against violent extremist Islamist groups in Bangladesh has sent a powerful signal that patience with radical elements in the country is running out. But could such protests also set an example to Muslim leaders elsewhere in the world to come together and protest against the rise of violent Islamism? An Iraqi helicopter has been shot down by Daesh over western Mosul for the first time since the battle to liberate the city began. We'll be taking a look at whether this marks an increase in the capabilities of the militant group. And members of the European Parliament have hit out at the new legislation by the Trump administration allowing private companies to purchase the browsing history of individuals without their consent. MEPs have stated that it contravenes the Privacy Shield data agreement signed by the former US President Barack Obama. All that and more over the next hour on this Friday edition of World in Focus. Reports are still coming through about the breaking news story in Sweden this afternoon. At 2:53 p.m. local time, police in Stockholm were informed that a vehicle had driven into crowds of people in a busy shopping district of the city. They had later released that the vehicle was a truck, and current reports suggest that three people have been killed and many more injured. We will keep you up to date with further information on those injured as it comes through. The truck is owned by the Swedish brewing company Spendrups, although it is believed that the truck was hijacked earlier in the day. Speaking to the TT news agency, the company's communications director, Martin Leith, said, quote, during a delivery to the restaurant Caliente, someone jumped into the driver's cabin and drove off with the car while the driver unloaded, end quote. The Swedish Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, has said at a press conference earlier today, quote, Sweden has been attacked. Everything indicates an act of terror, end quote. There are also reports of shots being fired, though those have not yet been confirmed. Our thoughts are, of course, with those in Stockholm right now. We'll keep you up to date with the information as it becomes available to us, and you can follow that on our Twitter feed and at sputniknews.com. The decision by US President Donald Trump, to attack a Syrian airbase overnight, which marks the first targeted strike against the Assad government by the United States, signifies a dramatic shift in his administration. In a very brief televised address to the American people, President Trump confirmed to the American people and the world that he had authorized the use of force against Syria. In response to the suspected use of sarin gas by the Assad government, the US fired 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles at the Shayarat airfield located in Homs in western Syria. For more on the details of the attack, our correspondent Matthew Aiton caught up with Ben Rich, a lecturer in international relations and security studies at the Curtin University in Perth.
So what has changed in the strategic calculations of the Trump administration? Of course, no more than a week ago, US Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley said that the US was no longer focused on getting rid of Assad, and Secretary of State Tillerson said that the fate of Assad is up to the Syrian people, but it seems that that all might now have changed. What do you think?
Well, this is the concern that I've, and we've been, sort of in my field, have been talking about over the last, even just 24 hours, is that we have these individuals, as you said, Tillerson and Nikki Haley, who seem to have more of a sense of a strategic approach of the administration, a vision about, well, how are we going to articulate our foreign policy? But then we have this wild card factor, which is that the figure of President Trump himself and the fact that from the outset, we have been concerned over the, his unpredictability, his kind of reflexivity to the conditions that approach him, that he's confronted with, and the fact that he doesn't seem to think in strategic terms. He doesn't seem to think in a long game kind of approach like his predecessor did, particularly as he developed into his second term. And as a result of this, we're seeing, which is what is really his first major foreign policy challenge and apparently a complete 180 turn on these previous policies outlined by the administration based on a single event.
Can you tell us more about the strikes themselves? I mean, how many Tomahawk missiles were launched? Where were they launched from and what exactly did they hit?
So as far as we are aware from the reporting, what we've seen is there are approximately 59 to 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles launched from the Mediterranean from a US missile destroyer. These targeted the airbase in Homs that was used to allegedly launch the chemical weapons attacks in Idlib, and it was primarily targeting the airframes themselves, these being Su-22 and MiG-23 strike aircraft, and the support infrastructure, the fuel depots, the rearmament machines used on the tarmac, and also this led to numerous casualties amongst the actual Syrian Air Force personnel.
Do you think, as some are suggesting, that this is a sign of the Trump administration's attempts to mend fences with the more, what some are calling, hawkish elements of the Republican Party, such as Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and McCain of Arizona, who have been calling for military intervention against Assad for years now?
Well, you know, this goes back to the original point, which is Trump actually thinking in these types of terms? And we've seen that both Graham and McCain particularly have been actually quite vocal opponents of Trump. And I'm not sure that this would really placate their more fundamental critiques of him as a result. So I'm not sure I find that a particularly convincing argument.
Just more on that point, as you said in your article, the one you wrote for The Conversation, while campaigning, Trump, quote, emphasised the need to embrace a transactional approach to foreign relations that placed little value on human rights, unquote. He also at one point suggested even working with Bashar al-Assad. Is this a sign that the Trump foreign policy position is really taking a major turn, do you think, or not?
Well, I mean, I think this is the problem, is we can't draw conclusions. We just honestly don't know what his next move will be. I mean, there is precedent for this in to some degree in U.S. foreign policy. We look back at Richard Nixon. He actually articulated a doctrine known as the Madman Doctrine, which was basically meant to keep his geopolitical rivals on its toes because they weren't able to predict his activities. But we just don't have a sense that Trump has that kind of level of Machiavellian approach to things. It seems to be much more in line with his history as a businessman, as a reality TV show figure, to just be acting on a very compulsive, reflexive, and some might even say emotive response to these types of events.
Okay, Professor Ben Rich, thank you for joining us here on World in Focus.
Thank you very much.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories all in one place. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
And following on from that report, the US attack has also raised some very serious concerns about the consequences for international law in what appears to be a clear breach by the Americans of the United Nations Charter governing military intervention. Our reporter Mark Hurst has been looking more closely at what this unilateral decision by the US means for the future of international law and what consequences, if any, Washington may face as a result.
Article 2 of the United Nations Charter reads, "All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations." But last night the United States confined that charter to the dustbin of history as it fired 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase in a move that could kill off any hope for a swift end to the Syrian war. US President Donald Trump attempted to justify the preemptive attack by claiming it was a response to an alleged chemical weapons attack in northwest Syria that left dozens of civilians dead. The Syrian government denied it was responsible, saying airstrikes had hit a chemical weapons arsenal in Idlib province, maintained by opposition rebel forces. Trump has previously committed his country to a non-interventionist strategy in Syria. But since taking up office in January, Trump has been under pressure from hawkish media and political figures in the US to take a tougher stance on Syria. The US airstrikes on Syria come just 2 weeks after American airstrikes in the Iraqi city of Mosul killed over 200 civilians and has led to speculation President Trump, whose popularity is the lowest of any American leader for over 70 years, was seeking to deflect attention away from American military action in neighbouring Iraq. So can the US action in Syria be justified? And what, if anything, will the rest of the international community do in response? Well, earlier I spoke with Professor Hans Kochler, the president of the International Progress Organization, a non-governmental body that has consultative status within the United Nations. Professor Hans Kochler, does this attack on Syria have any legal basis under international law?
It certainly does not. According to international law, the use of force is restricted to very specific cases, namely when an attack occurs against a country in self-defense, that is according to Article 51 of the Charter, or when the United Nations Security Council authorizes the use of force under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. This was not the case, and for that reason it is obviously, the attack is obviously illegal.
And has the United States' refusal to seek explicit authority from the United Nations Security Council, does that undermine the United Nations in a serious way?
It does undermine the authority of the United Nations, and this is of course a problem that has existed since the beginning of the World Organization, and that is related to the veto rule in the United Nations Security Council. But still, a power that is a country that wants to use force in international relations can and must not circumvent the United Nations Security Council. And if for whatever reasons, whether because of the veto of other permanent members or a lack of a simple majority, this approval is not forthcoming, no member state of the United Nations must enter into an armed confrontation.
And if any other country other than the United States had launched a similar attack on another sovereign country without the consent of the UN Security Council, what kind of consequences might they expect from such action?
There might be a collective enforcement action against that particular country. We have seen it numerous times in earlier years. For instance, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, there was a swift military action on the basis of the United Nations Security Council resolution, and there were several other similar cases. So the problem, of course, is a kind of policy of double standards, and the fact that a major power such as the United States that has veto right in the Security Council will get away with its illegal conduct, whatever the circumstances may be.
And would Syria be justified following this attack to strike back against the United States? Obviously, it is in a very serious predicament with the Syrian war going on, and it may not want to. But do they have a right under international law, the Syrians, to self-defense and to retaliation under these circumstances?
According to the United Nations Charter, a country that is attacked, that is under attack, has the right to defend itself as long as the United Nations Security Council has not taken action itself. That is the provision of Article 51 of the Charter. So that right does exist on paper, but of course it is in many circumstances when there is such an imbalance of power relations between the intervening or attacking state and the state attacked, it is not realistic that a country would make use of this right.
And are you surprised that the United Kingdom has given such strong backing to the US actions when both Britain and America have in the past been at the forefront of calls to uphold international law?
No, I'm not surprised, because this is the policy of double standards. These two and other allied countries have been practicing all along since several decades, and particularly since the end of the Cold War. That means since the beginning of the 1990s. They have quite often sided with the United States in military attacks. Also, for instance, not to forget, against former Yugoslavia, and they have been calling for respect of the rule of law only when it served their interests.
And this unilateral decision by the US to attack Syria comes at a time when the UK and France were actually calling for fresh diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict. Where does that leave the UK in particular? And do you think they will be more hesitant to join military action with their US partners, given the international legal issues that surround such involvement or engagement?
It is very unfortunate. Unilateral military actions like this one do undermine further efforts at a peaceful settlement of the conflict and do completely destroy an atmosphere of trust and mutual confidence that is required for negotiations. As far as the United Kingdom is concerned, I think it will just go along with a strategic partner, the United States. And we have seen similar declarations not only from the UK, by the way, but also from Australia and from NATO countries, such as Denmark or even Germany earlier today.
Okay, Professor Hans Kochler, many thanks for your contribution today. It was very interesting. Thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
You're welcome.
Well, to discuss this further, I am now joined by Arthur West, Chairman of the Scottish Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. The UK government is wholeheartedly backing American action here in Syria, despite, as we've just heard from Professor Kochler, the clear breach of international law that has arisen from this attack. But this intervention could spark an even larger conflict. How concerned should we be that this could lead to a direct conflict between the US and Russia?
Well, I think the situation's very concerning. I mean, this risky and hasty action does certainly flag up that possibility, and it's to be hoped that it doesn't happen, but it certainly, you know, makes the situation of an international conflict more risky.
And where does this action leave the reputation of the United Nations? They've been completely sidelined again, haven't they?
Well, yes, the United Nations have been sidelined, and that's, you know, desperately disappointing, particularly given the fact, you know, yet again people have been killed as a result of this action. You know, it's very disappointing that this has happened, and the United Nations should have an important role to play in these situations, and, you know, for it to be bypassed again is really very uncalled for behaviour by the US.
And what's your assessment of the UK's position? I mean, they had been calling, along with France, for fresh diplomatic efforts to kind of resolve the Syrian conflict, but now they seem to be wholeheartedly supporting the US action in Syria.
Well, yeah, again, I mean, it's really disappointing that, again, the UK has followed the US line lavishly, and only in the last few weeks we've actually had to give the United Nations a bit of credit. There's been discussions on a global ban treaty on nuclear weapons, which would be a very successful move towards a more peaceful world. And the UK in those talks has followed the US line and not taken part in the talks. Yet again, in this case of these airstrikes in Syria, it's falling into the US line slavishly. And that's really disappointing, and there requires to be a rethink of that. And my advice to the UK government to get back to exploring and trying to play a constructive role of having diplomatic solutions to the issues in Syria.
And how big a setback are these airstrikes in terms of the efforts to try and bring this brutal war to an end?
Oh, they're a real setback, because it really means that the next few days in particular are very worrying. It's been done without any, it's a unilateral action without any legal authorisation or independent verification. And it's really, it's a real sad day, and we only hope we can maybe recover somewhat from it in the next few days.
And can we read anything into the timing? Last week there were substantiated reports of US airstrikes killing hundreds of civilians in Mosul, but again, no action against the US by the United Nations. Yeah. How convenient are these airstrikes in Syria in terms of deflecting attention away from these actions in Iraq by the United States?
Well, that's the worrying aspect of it, because obviously the information we're getting out of Mosul is that there's dreadful suffering happening there, killing and suffering, and it does make you pose the question. I think a lot of most reasonable people will pose the question, is this an attempt really to deflect attention away from that and deflect attention away from other issues that might be causing some problems for President Trump?
Well, Arthur West, many thanks for joining us today. It's a developing story. I'm sure we'll return to it again very soon, unfortunately. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Earlier today, I spoke to Dr. Dan Lomas from the University of Salford's Intelligence and Security Studies And I began by asking him if this apparent U-turn in Donald Trump's rhetoric would raise major concerns in the intelligence community and among America's allies.
On one level, maybe yes, but it also shows that Trump is unpredictable, I suppose, as a policymaker. If we're looking at what he was saying just last week, where he was talking about an America First policy and suggesting that America would adopt an isolationist policy because it's no longer the world's policeman, to the rhetoric you're seeing yesterday, I think you're starting to see a Trump presidency beginning to realize that the US does need to take an increasingly assertive role when it comes to foreign policy. And I think on that sense, he is in line with a lot of his military and intelligence advisors on the need for America to be increasingly assertive. And you start to see that when you look at the rhetoric of General James Mattis. Mattis has been quite hard line when it comes to talking about not just Syria, but also concerns about Russia. So you're starting to see Trump move, I suppose, increasingly in line with the advice provided by Mattis and others, more away from this isolationist tendency that he's presented previously.
Mm-hmm. And for his allies, then, will they now be trying to quickly think, actually, we maybe do have an interventionist administration here? Will that be something that they might have planned for and thought that maybe this would happen in the long run anyway?
I think it's difficult when you look at Trump's rhetoric. I think it's difficult for any government to try and judge what he's thinking. And you see that between, you know, the tweets, the regular tweets that he gives out that are often contradictory, often pretty vague. So I think in terms of long-term planning, I think it will be difficult for any government to plan what comes next. I think we need something more substantive with Trump's vision for future US policy in the region. I do think, however, that there has been concern within Britain and other countries, NATO countries in particular, that America is starting to disengage from many of the security frameworks that they set up in preceding decades. Now, you might be seeing, and I say might because this only just happened in the early hours this morning, you might be seeing a president increasingly starting to become more on board with the traditional views maybe of areas of Washington, London, and other areas in particular. So I think that this change could potentially be welcome in some areas because it shows you have a president that's realizing that an America First policy isn't the wisest and it's difficult to pursue that.
Well, Dr. Lamas, thank you very much for your views today. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We are above all the latest developments and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik. Telling the Untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up in the programme, the decision by over 100,000 Muslim clerics to gather in protest against violent extremist Islamist groups in Bangladesh has sent a powerful signal that patience with radical elements in the country is running out. But could such protests also set an example to Muslim leaders elsewhere in the world to come together and protest against the rise of violent extremism? We'll have more in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Brave New World.
If you're going to San Francisco.
That was a song we all knew in the 1960s. Do you know something? The hippies are coming back. Listen to Brave New World. Find out.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's Daily the Global Current Affairs programme World in Focus with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland every weekday from 4pm in the UK, 11am Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys.
When and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
I'm Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know markets are doubling down. Not you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the decision by over 100,000 Muslim clerics to gather and protest against violent extremist Islamist groups in Bangladesh has sent a powerful signal that patience with radical elements in the country is running out. But could such protests also set an example to religious leaders elsewhere in the world to come together and protest against the rise of violent extremism? And members of the European Parliament have hit out at the new legislation by the Trump administration allowing private companies to purchase the browsing history of individuals without their consent, stating that this contravenes the Privacy Shield data agreement signed by former US President Barack Obama. This is World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 28 minutes past the hour. The rise of violent extremist Islamism is a phenomenon that has plagued countries all over the world. In recent years, it has become a growing problem in Bangladesh, with attacks increasing over the past few years. But as our reporter Mark Hurst has been finding out, mainstream Islamic leaders are now leading a fight back against that trend that could inspire similar protests across the world.
That's the sound of 100,000 Muslim clerics and preachers who this week rallied in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, in protest against what they regard as the violent power grab by radical extremist Islamists. There has been a resurgence of attacks by militant groups in the Muslim majority nation in recent years, sparking international concern that extremist elements in the country could eventually take over. But should the example set by Islamic leaders in Bangladesh be followed by their counterparts in the rest of the world? Well, earlier I spoke with Dr. Parveen Akhtar, a lecturer in politics at Aston University, to discuss that possibility. Dr. Akhtar, should Muslim leaders around the world be doing more to follow the lead set in Bangladesh and have more public high-profile opposition to radical Islamists?
That's a really interesting question, because I think if you look at Bangladesh itself, that is an interesting case. In 2010, secularism was included once again as a key principle of the constitution. So it was a key principle in 71 when it was formed, and then it was taken out, and in 2010 it was put in again. And it's really unusual amongst Muslim majority nations to have a secular constitution where religion isn't the guiding principle of the laws and legislations of the land. So that's an interesting case in itself. If we're thinking about leadership, like unlike in other religions, say for example Catholicism, whereby there's a clear religious leader, there's no single authority in Islam. So if there's no single authority, then the question of leadership and who are the Muslim leaders is actually quite fraught in itself.
And are some Muslim leaders afraid to speak out too strongly against radical Islam and extremist Islamists for perhaps genuine personal safety reasons, or do they even fear a backlash within their own communities?
The internet and the dark web is an important area where I think radicalization takes place. I mean, that's kind of established now. The question is whether some Muslim leaders have the kind of technological skills and know-how to engage with those most at risk of that radicalization, who are accessing platforms that they are quite different from those that, you know, those leaders themselves are used to. So if your target audience is those who are most susceptible, you know, I'm not sure how speaking out in such rallies or, you know, publicly speaking out in this way is going to be most useful. I think, though, that the protests, if we're thinking about those protests, that they're symbolically important, possibly more so for non-Muslims than Muslims themselves. The majority of Muslims don't subscribe to such views, and sometimes I feel they think that they're hounded by the constant need to sort of justify their own faith in that way.
How does these kind of protests resonate? I mean, what is the view amongst the ordinary Muslim society to these kinds of protests?
I think the Muslim society isn't, you know, one fixed kind of monolithic group. So, you know, there's going to be lots of different views amongst the Muslims. Many of them who don't, you know, would absolutely subscribe to the view that, you know, these kind of attacks are wrong. You know, radical extremism is not in their name. Now, whether some of them agree to the way that these protests take place, you know, some of them might feel that, you know, why should we need to go out there and engage in these kind of protests to say radical Islamists don't speak for us, because that should be obvious that they don't speak for us. However, others take a completely different view, and they say, well, still done in the name of Islam, so it's upon us to go and sort of clarify what we think Islam is and what Islam means in our own lives.
And it's often forgotten that a majority of those killed by Islamic extremists are themselves Muslims. Could more be done to promote solidarity between mainstream Islam and non-Muslim societies against the threat posed by the extremists, to show a sense of solidarity?
That's a really good question. I think that's really interesting. If you look at, for example, the key differences between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, for example, Al-Qaeda absolutely was very much about freeing Muslim lands from foreign occupation. You know, that was their primary motivator. ISIS are not concerned about freeing land from occupation. They want to obtain more land, or their primary motivator. But they were concerned, really, with the purification of faith. They wanted to start from the inside and work outwards. So anyone who didn't agree with, you know, their version of faith or religion were deemed non-Muslim. So, you know, the list for ISIS in terms of who is and who isn't a Muslim, they, you know, one, the very short list, who is a Muslim, anybody who agrees with them, and the list for who isn't a Muslim or a real Muslim, as they say, you know, it's very long, from Sufis to Shias, etc. But also, actually, there's another way of looking at it, and that's just that if you think about how terrorist attacks are reported, if you look at how terrorist attacks which take place in MENA countries, so Middle East and North African countries, you know, the kind of coverage that those attacks, those bombings, killings there receive in Western European press is very different from the coverage that, you know, if attacks take place in, say, the US or in Western countries. So I think there's also a question of how those kind of attacks are reported themselves as well.
And finally, you touched on earlier the resonance of these kinds of protests we've seen in Bangladesh carry more weight amongst non-Muslims. But would large public profile demonstrations by Muslim leaders in Europe help alter often warped perceptions of Islam among non-Muslims in the EU?
I mean, one would hope that it would be as simple as that, but But actually, I think there's been an increasing kind of cynicism within some parts of the popular media in Europe, where leaders who speak out against extremism, the idea is that you can say as many times as you want, Islam is a religion of peace, but if it's done in your name, then actually, you know, how useful is it for you to keep on going through the ritual of saying it? But I do think that actually many Muslims leaders do rally against extremism, but it's probably better to be working with local communities at the local level rather than this top-down approach. And also, I guess that the other question is about mixed messages within the popular press about Muslims is problematic. So, for example, there was a case of Fatima Manji, the Channel 4 reporter, who was publicly derided by Calvin McKenzie of The Sun for being a Muslim reporter wearing a headscarf reporting on a terrorist incident. So I think, you know, those kinds of mixed messages about Muslims within the popular press are also kind of problematic in terms of perceptions of Muslims amongst non-Muslims.
Dr. Parveen Akhtar, many thanks. Very interesting contribution. Thanks for speaking to us today on World in Focus.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Members of the European Parliament have hit out at new US legislation by the Trump administration that makes it possible for private companies to purchase individuals' browsing histories without their explicit consent. In contravention of the Privacy Shield Data Agreement signed by former US President Barack Obama. Privacy Shield is the deal between the EU and the US that's supposed to safeguard all personal data on EU citizens held on computer systems in the US from being subject to mass surveillance by the US National Security Agency. The data can refer to any transaction, web purchases, cars or clothing, involving an EU citizen whose data is held on US servers. However, members of the EU Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs Committee, or LIBE, are said that the agreement, although signed July 2016, still does not give watertight guarantees that EU citizens' data will not be compromised or gathered by US intelligence agencies as bulk data. Well, to look at this further, I'm joined online now by our man in London, Jim Ensom. Jim, just fill us in on the background to all of this.
Well, in Europe, the EU has very strict laws on data privacy. Now, when you do anything over the internet, when you buy something, you might get it on Amazon, when you do something on Facebook or Twitter, etc., there is data, your personal data is collected. And many, many years ago, there was an agreement made that if any of your data ends up on an American computer server, which a lot of it does, we've got to make sure there was an agreement called the Safe Harbor Agreement that the US said to the EU, we will make sure that all data on EU citizens that's held on servers located in America will not be exposed to bulk surveillance. Well, along comes Edward Snowden, and he revealed that under a program called PRISM, that in fact the National Security Agency, the NSA in America, did have some access to EU data. And he brought a case in Ireland, which is the headquarters of Facebook, and he argued that in fact, because this was revealed that PRISM had access to it, EU citizens' data was no longer safe from being probed and bulk data collection by the US authorities. And in fact, the European Court of Judgment in September 2015 ruled that, in fact, the Safe Harbor Agreement was invalid. And that sent shockwaves. Because in the commercial world, you do need to transfer data. Lots of big companies swap data across the Atlantic every day. Millions of transactions are recorded, but more importantly, millions of bytes of data on people's personal data are collected, whether you're talking Apple or Facebook or whatever, or just simply a transaction you do online. If it's held on American servers, the original Safe Harbor Agreement was one that said it was basically a memo of mutual understanding, effectively, to say we won't spy on your citizens' data. Is that all right? So because it was done as classed as invalid by the European Court of Justice, this new thing was brought in, which took several months to organize, called Privacy Shield. And so it's basically Safe Harbor 2. And Privacy Shield was intended to ensure that all European citizens' data is free from mass surveillance in the US, and if there was a problem, then there would be a tribunal which you could go to. But ever since the deal was signed, privacy groups have been saying, well, in fact, there's a court case going on right now about it, challenging it, because it says there are no checks and balances, and indeed anything could happen.
Mm-hmm. So what exactly have the members of the European Parliament been saying?
Well, since he took over, Donald Trump, the US president, has been signing a load of executive orders. He is very, very easy. Whereas President Obama bowed to privacy campaigners and put in checks and balances and signed the Privacy Shield Agreement, Trump, quite clearly, the Trump administration is much loose on this. And what the MEPs in the European Parliament have said is that now, under new legislation, some personal data may be sold off outside of the Privacy Shield Agreement. And they're saying that several other things have allowed the NSA and other security services in the US access to data. And they're saying, hang on a minute, we need an investigation into this. Because the Civil and Justice and Home Affairs Committee, which is known as LIBE, the LIBE Committee in the EU, said that the agreement still doesn't give watertight guarantees that EU citizens' data will not be compromised or be gathered by the EU intelligence agency. And what the report says, and I'll just read you a little bit of this, Carolyn, because I think it's relevant. The direction that the Trump administration is taking on data protection issues is very concerning, they say in this report. The European Commission needs to look urgently at the effect of the reversal of an Obama-era law that prevents selling users' data without their explicit consent. This must be part of a wide review of the Privacy Shield Agreement to ensure that EU citizens' data is effectively protected. And that's what the report says, and that's quite a damning statement, because quite clearly they're suggesting that, you know, the original Safe Harbor Agreement was deemed invalid by the European Court of Justice. The one that took over from Privacy Shield is no less safe at protecting it. And that's a very significant move. So the EU is now moving into some sort of probe by the Commission, which will lead to urgent talks with the Trump administration.
And, well, I mean, what next? Are we going to see another version, the third, you've got Safe Harbor, Privacy Shield. Will they work on a new one now?
Well, Safe Harbor took months and months and months to get organized, because you've got to talk about what data is. You've got to talk about, you know, data protection, data masking, for instance. You can do that in the computer world. It took ages and ages for them to come to an agreement on Privacy Shield. And if they find, I mean, obviously the European Commission is going to have a probe into this. Quite clearly, the commissioners are going to have to go over and start talks with the Trump administration. Privacy and rights groups are already putting a lot of pressure on it. So I think what you're going to find is, if over the next coming months, there's going to be a big argument between the EU and the US. Now, you know that already there is a gap between the EU and the Trump administration, because, of course, he doesn't like the trade deal that they've spent years agreeing. And part of that trade deal actually is about data privacy. You know, how can I trade with a company in America, and how do we agree rules of me transferring data? How does my computer system work with yours, if you want to put it really, really simply? So I predict that there's going to be a lot of pressure from human rights and privacy groups. There's going to be months and months of wrangling, and this will be a test of the Trump administration and where it goes. But quite clearly, there has been, as I said in that thing that I've just read out to you, there is quite clearly a feeling within the EU that the agreements that were done under the Obama administration on privacy and data collection have clearly been moved quite a way by the Trump administration, and I see a lot of conflict coming up.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is all very interesting. Thank you very much for getting us up to speed, Jim Ensom.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, an Iraqi helicopter has been shot down by Daesh over western Mosul for the first time since the battle to liberate the city began. We'll be taking a look at whether this marks an increase in the capabilities of the militant group, and we will bring you an update on the latest information available on the terror attack in Sweden this afternoon.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We're all doing together, you ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann programme.
Oddly enough, it's not non-fiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, an Iraqi helicopter has been shot down by Daesh over western Mosul for the first time since the battle to liberate the city began. We'll be taking a look at whether this marks an increase in the capabilities of the militant group, and we will bring you all the latest information available to us on the attack in Sweden this afternoon. An Iraqi helicopter has been downed by Daesh over Mosul for the first time since the battle for Iraq's second city began. The Iraqi government have expressed their concern that Daesh may have gotten hold of heavy anti-aircraft artillery to bring the chopper down. For more, here's Matthew Aiton.
Two pilots from the Iraqi military were killed yesterday when their helicopters were shot down over the western side of Mosul by Daesh militants. The helicopter was aiding local forces on the ground with air support to police forces fighting Daesh on the western side of Mosul, according to a statement released by the Iraqi military. Mosul is now the last stronghold of Daesh in the country, which was seized less than 3 years ago and declared as part of its so-called caliphate. But exactly what kinds of anti-aircraft weapons Daesh has remains a point of speculation for many a commentator and journalist. Joining us now to give an insight into that is Talha Abdulrazak, a researcher at the Strategy and Security Institute at the University of Exeter. Talha, thanks for joining us here on World in Focus. Daesh reportedly downed the first chopper over Mosul yesterday, or at least it's the first that the Iraqi government has acknowledged. What kind of anti-aircraft weaponry do Daesh have, and where did they get it from?
Well, I think the anti-aircraft weaponry that Daesh have is actually quite limited. In terms of
you know, what kind of armaments they have, we have to bear in mind that the helicopter they downed was involved in a close air support operation, which means it was flying quite low and therefore it was vulnerable to even small arms fire. So we're talking about even Kalashnikovs. You know, in terms of the kind of capabilities that they have, when they took over Mosul, obviously, they took over a lot of military bases where there was, quite substantial amounts of U.S. Weaponry there. So that was involved, like, in 2014 when the army fled, they left behind all their stockpiles of weapons. So you're looking at, American-made weapons. They're not going to be necessarily the best that the Americans can produce, but they'll have some kind of capability. I would imagine, though, that in this particular instance, it was brought down by small arms fire or even by rocket-propelled grenades, at very close range.
Yes, because I've seen a lot of reports that have said the group's sophistication in terms of weaponry has steadily developed since 2014. How has Daesh managed to do this? And again, where has the flow of its weapons come from and where have they gotten their money from?
Well, actually, they've actually managed to develop indigenous weapons as well. So even like variations of cheaply made drones, for example. So if you look at even groups like Hamas operating in the Gaza Strip, they've managed to develop their own rockets. Yes, they're quite primitive, and I'm not just talking about the what's known as the Qassam rockets that can only go a few kilometers. I'm talking about even the laser rockets where they were able to strike Tel Aviv. Now, the technological roots of that came from, obviously, reverse engineering Iranian rocketry. In terms of Daesh, as I mentioned earlier, they've actually developed their air capability. So before that, they used to use reconnaissance drones. And it's just simply a normal drone with a camera attached at the bottom will fly over. Their engineers have managed to somehow advance them and provide them with the capability of actually attaching munitions to these drones. And they actually use them in kind of, it's the wrong term considering a drone is not actually alive, but kind of like suicide missions or kamikaze missions, whereby the drone itself will drop the munition or fly the munition directly into its targets. This is a kind of innovation that we've seen from Daesh over the past couple of years. Although it's been overblown in certain media outlets, it's not something which has it's more of a tactical weapon as opposed to an operational strategic weapon.
And moving on, just finally, reports are saying that Daesh militants are now putting up very tough resistance in the remaining district under their control in northwestern Mosul. How is the operation to liberate the city going, and has increased US air support helped or hindered that operation, would you say?
Well, there's a two-pronged answer to that. I mean, you've got the military and the political aspect. So let's start with the military aspect. It's going quite slowly, and that was kind of predictable. I mean, when Haider al-Abadi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, gave predictions and promises that the operation will be over by late 2016 or the end of 2016, quite a few analysts, including myself, said that that was never going to happen. And indeed, that has not happened. And he's had to revise his estimations. The reason being is because, fanatic terrorists that they may be, they're still a highly trained, predominantly light infantry and motorized infantry force. They know what they're doing. A lot of these would have had military training either outside of Iraq as foreign fighters, or indeed, if they are Iraqi, they would have been conscripted into the Iraqi army under the Saddam Hussein regime. So you're looking at a highly trained group of a lot of them being professionals or former professionals. In terms of the equipment that they're using, they're also using the sniper rifles and long-range weapons within narrow kill zones that they've been preparing over the past couple of years. ISIS strategists know that they're not going to hold on to Mosul, and they always knew that from the start. Any concerted attempt, military attempt to retake the city was always going to succeed because it was going to involve, U.S. air power, which frankly is going to be too devastating for them to hold off. However, the devastation caused by such munitions provides them with a kind of a political gain in that they can point to what's happened, as in the attack, I think it was last week in Mosul, the week before, where, some estimations say 511 civilians were killed in a U.S. airstrike or several U.S. airstrikes on the same region. That's a, catastrophic figure. It's also a massive PR gain for ISIS militants who can point to this and say, well, look, we were trying to defend the predominantly Sunni Arab population of Mosul, and this is what's happened. This has been encouraged by the Baghdad-led regime. It's also been supported by the U.S. Air Force, and this is the result. More Muslims dead, and they can use that as a rallying cry. So that's the military and the political aspects, I think, briefly covered.
Okay, brilliant. Talha Abdulrazak, thank you very much for your time.
No problem. Thank you very much.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Just to give you an update of the events in Sweden today, where just before 3 p.m. local time, a truck was driven into crowds on a busy shopping street in Stockholm. The truck hit pedestrians just yards from the scene of the suicide bombing in 2010. The truck had been hijacked earlier in the day. Early reports are that three people have been killed. The police have confirmed that there had been fatalities, but have not themselves released official figures. The Swedish Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, said that one suspect had been arrested by the police in the immediate wake of this incident. However, Swedish police later appeared to contradict that, denying any related arrests had been made. Our thoughts are, of course, with those in Stockholm today, and you can follow that and the latest on our Twitter feed and at sputniknews.com. And that's all that we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. We'll be back with you tomorrow, 11 a.m. UK time, 1 p.m. in Moscow, for World in Focus Weekly, where I'll be joined by Matthew Aitken and Mark Hurst for a slightly more informal look back at the big stories over the past week. Until then, this is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and just a moment, we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartmann Show. And from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartmann. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights. On Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case. Simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Will the gig economy boost or destroy the economies of developing countries? Will governments introduce taxes on corporations that hire workers in the third world through the internet? Does the gig economy make a farce of the idea of protecting Western countries from the effect of economic migrants? Tune into Level Talk this week.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunday, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
increased activities in Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in.